afternoon. Well, we've had Chemist Corner, we've had Steve Wan, and now we've got our book reading. But before, of course, we go on with that, we have to have a word from the people who make our little radio station possible.
The Araluen Valley Hotel offers visitors and locals a welcoming bar with cold beer on tap, a games room and a beer garden. Open 5 days a week, Wednesday to Sunday, with delicious Sunday roasts at lunch and dinner. Bistro meals serve from 12 to 2pm and 6 to 8pm. Strictly observing COVID guidelines, every visitor is required to register on entry by digital sign-on. Araluen Valley Hotel. Find us on Facebook or phone 4846 4023. Supporting our local radio station, Braidwood FM 88.9.
At the Braidwood Servicemen's Club, you can enjoy a range of activities designed to provide something for everyone. Enjoy a round of golf on a 9-hole golf course or a game of bowls, squash or pool. Friday night entertainment a couple of times a month and sport and music channels on big screen TVs. Or have a Chinese or Australian meal at the restaurant. Braidwood Servicemen's Club, 48422108. Proud sponsors of Braidwood Community Radio.
For all your plumbing and gas fitting needs, Braidwood and Districts Plumbing is here to help.
They can assist with hot water installations and repairs, new builds and renovations,
block drains, septic system installations and repairs, and all other plumbing services.
They also offer 1.7 to 5.5 tonne excavator and tipper hire, and are fully licensed and insured. No job is too big or too small.
Give them a call on 0438 564 015. Braidwood and Districts Plumbing, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
Braidwood FM sponsor, Braidwood Air Conditioning, is your local air conditioning specialist for the installation and servicing of commercial and residential premises. Ryan is licensed and insured and has been in the industry for over 12 years. You can contact Ryan on 0405 274 227 or email him at info@braidwoodairconditioning.com.au or visit the website braidwoodairconditioning.com.au.
And a big thank you to our sponsors, as I said. Without them, our little station mightn't be here. But we've been reading Ivanhoe by Sir Walter Scott, and we're starting to get to a rather interesting part where Prince John gets a rather unfortunate wake-up call. Prince John had proceeded thus far and was about to give the signal for retiring from the lists when a small billet was put into his hand. "From whence?" said Prince John, looking at the person by whom it was delivered. "From foreign lands, my lord, but from whence I know not," replied his attendant. "A Frenchman brought it hither, who said he had ridden all night and day to put it into the hands of your highness." The prince looked narrowly at the superscription and then at the seal, placed so as to secure the flock silk with which the billet was surrounded and which bore the impression of three fleurs-de-lis. John then opened the billet with apparent agitation, which visibly and greatly increased when he perused the contents, which were expressed in these words: "Take heed to yourself, for the devil is unchained." The prince turned as pale as death, looked first on the earth, then to heaven, like a man who has received news that sentence of execution has been passed upon him. Recovering from the first effects of his surprise, he took Voldemar Fitzurse and De Bracy aside and put the billet into their hands. "It means," he added in a faltering voice, "that my brother Richard has obtained his freedom." "Oh, this may be a false alarm or a forged letter," said De Bracy. It's France's own hand and seal," replied Prince John. "It is time then," said Fitzurse, "to draw our party to a head, either at York or some other centric or place. A few days later and it will be indeed too late. Your Highness must break short this present mummery. The yeomen and commons, said De Bracy, must not be dismissed discontented for lack of their share in the sports. The day, said Waldemere, is not yet very far spent. Let the archers shoot a few rounds at the target, and the prize be adjudged. This will be an abundant fulfilment of the prince's promises, so far as this herd of Saxon serfs is concerned. I thank thee, Waldemere, said the prince. You remind me, too, that I have a debt to pay to that insolent peasant who yesterday insulted our person. Our banquet also shall go forward tonight as we proposed. Were this my last hour of power, it should be an hour sacred to revenge and to pleasure. Let new cares come with tomorrow's new day. The sound of the trumpet soon recalled those spectators who had already begun to leave the field, and proclamation was made that Prince John, suddenly called by high, peremptory public duties, held himself obliged to discontinue the entertainments of tomorrow's festival. Nevertheless, that unwilling so many good yeomen should depart without a trial of skill, he was pleased to appoint them before leaving the ground presently to execute the competition of archery intended for the morrow. To the best archer a prize was to be awarded, being a bugle horn mounted with silver and a silken baldric richly ornamented with a medallion of St. Hubert, the patron of sylvan sport. More than 30 yeomen at first presented themselves as competitors, several of whom were rangers and underkeepers in the royal forests of Needwood and Charnwood. When, however, the archers understood whom they were to be matched, upwards of 20 withdrew from the contest, unwilling to encounter the dishonour of almost certain defeat. For in those days the skill of each celebrated marksman was as well known for many miles around him as the qualities of a horse trained at Newmarket are familiar to those who frequent that well-known meeting. The diminished list of competitors for sylvan fame still amounted to 8. Prince John stepped from his royal seat to view more nearly the persons of those chosen yeomen, several of whom were wearing royal livery. Having satisfied his curiosity by this investigation, he looked for the object of his resentment, whom he observed standing on the same spot and with the same composed countenance which he had exhibited upon the preceding day. "Fellow," said Prince John, "I guessed by thy insolent babble you were no true lover of the longbow, and I see you dare not venture your skill among such merry men as stand yonder."
"Under favour, sir," replied the yeoman, "I have another reason for refraining to shoot, besides the fearing discomfiture and disgrace."
"And what is the other reason?" said Prince John, who for some cause, which perhaps he could not himself have explained, felt a painful curiosity respecting this individual.
"Because," replied the woodman, "I know not if these yeomen and I are used to shoot at the same marks, and because, moreover, I know how your grace might relish the winning of a third prize by one who has unwittingly fallen under your displeasure."
Prince John coloured as he put the question.
"What is your name, yeoman?"
"Locksley," answered the yeoman.
"Then, Locksley," said Prince John, "you shall shoot in your turn. When these yeomen have displayed their skill, if you carry the prize, I will add to it 20 nobles, but if you lose it, you will be stripped of your Lincoln green and scourged out of the lists with bowstrings for a wordy and an insolent braggart."
"And how if I refuse to shoot on such a wager?" said the yeoman. "Your grace's power, supported as it is by so many men-at-arms, may indeed easily strip and scourge me, but cannot compel me to bend or draw my bow."
"If you refuse my fair offer," said the prince, "the provost of the lists shall cut your bowstring, break your bow and arrows, and expel you from the presence as a faint-hearted craven."
"This is no fair chance you put on me, proud prince," said the yeoman, "to compel me to peril myself against the best archers of Leicester and Staffordshire, under the penalty of infamy if they should overshoot me. Nevertheless, I will obey your pleasure."
"Look to him close, men-at-arms," said Prince John. "His heart is sinking. I am jealous lest he attempt to escape the trial. And you, good fellows, shoot badly round. A buck and a butt of wine are ready for your refreshment in yonder tent when the prize is won."
A target was placed at the upper end of the southern avenue, which led to the lists. The contending archers took their station in turn at the bottom of the southern access, the distance between that station and the mark allowing full distance for what is called a shot at rovers. The archers, having previously determined by lot their order of precedence, were to shoot each three shafts in succession. The sports were regulated by an officer of inferior rank, termed the provost of the games, for the high rank of the marshals of the lists would have been held degraded had they condescended to superintend the sport of the yeomanry. One by one, the archers, stepping forward, delivered their shafts yeoman-like and bravely. Of 24 arrows shot in succession, 10 were fixed in the target, and the others ranged so near it that, considering the distance of the mark, it was accounted good archery. Of the 10 shafts which hit the target, 2 within the inner ring were shot by Hubert, a forester in the service of Malvoisin, who was accordingly pronounced victorious. "Now, Locksley," said Prince John to the bold yeoman with a bitter smile, "will you try conclusion with Hubert, or will you yield up bow, baldric, and quiver to the provost of sports?"
"It be no better," said Locksley. "I am content to try my fortune, on condition that when I have shot 2 shafts at yonder mark of Hubert's, he shall be bound to shoot 1 at that which I shall propose."
"Well, that is but fair," answered Prince John, "and it shall not be refused you. If you do beat this braggart Hubert, I will fill the bugle with silver pennies for you."
"A man can do but his best," answered Hubert, "but my grandsire drew a good long bow at Hastings, and I trust not to dishonour his memory."
The former target was now removed, and a fresh one of the same size placed in its room. Hubert, who, as a victor in the first trial of skill, had the right to shoot first, took his aim with great deliberation, long measuring the distance with his eye, while he held his hand, his bended bow, with the arrow placed on the string. At length he made a step forward, and raising the bow at the full stretch of his left arm, till the centre, or grasping place, was nigh level with his face, he drew his bowstring to his ear. The arrow whistled through the air, and lighted within the inner ring of the target, but not exactly in the centre.
"You have not allowed for the wind, Hubert," said his antagonist, bending his bow, "or that had been a better shot."
So saying, and without showing the least anxiety to pause upon his aim, Locksley stepped up to the appointed station and shot his arrow as carelessly in appearance as if he had not even looked at the mark. He was speaking almost at the instant that the shaft left the bowstring, yet it alighted in the target 2 inches nearer to the white spot which marked the centre than that of Hubert.
"By the light of heaven," said Prince John to Hubert, "you suffer that renegade knave to overcome you? You are worthy of the gallows."
Hubert had but one set speech for all occasions.
"And your highness were to hang me," he said, "a man can but do his best. Nevertheless, my grandsire drew a good bow." "The foul fiend on your grandsire and all his generation," interrupted John. "Shoot, knave, and shoot thy best, or it shall be the worse for you."
Thus exhorted, Hubert resumed his place, and not neglecting the caution with which he had received from his adversary, he made the necessary allowances for a very light air of wind, which had just arisen, and shot so successfully that his arrow alighted in the very centre of the target.
"A Hubert! A Hubert!" shouted the populace,
more interested in a known person than in a stranger.
"In the clout! In the clout! A Hubert forever!"
"You cannot mend that shot, Locksley," said the prince with an insulting smile.
"I will notch his shaft with him and for him, however," replied Locksley.
And letting fly his arrow with a little more precaution than before, it lighted right upon that of his competitor, which it split to shivers. The people who stood around were so astonished at his wonderful dexterity that they could not even give vent to their surprise in their usual clamour.
"This must be the devil, and no man of flesh and blood," whispered the yeomen to each other. "Such archery was never seen since a bow was first bent in Britain."
"And now," said Locksley. I will crave your grace's permission to plant such a mark as is used in the North Country, and welcome every brave yeoman who shall try a shot at it to win a smile from the bonny lass he loves best. He then turned to leave the lists. Let your guards attend me, he said, if you please. I go but to cut a rod from the next willow bush. Prince John made a signal that some attendants should follow him, in case of his escape, but the cry of shame, shame, which burst from the multitude, induced him to alter his ungenerous purpose. Locksley returned almost instantly with a willow wand about 6 feet in length and perfectly straight, and rather thicker than a man's thumb. He began to peel this with great composure, observing at the same time that to ask a good woodsman to shoot at a target so broad as to hitherto been used was to put shame upon his skill. For his own part, he said, and in the land where he was bred, men would as soon take for their mark King Arthur's round table, which held 60 knights around it. A child of 7 years, he said, might hit yonder target with a headless shaft, but, added he, walking deliberately to the other end of the lists and sticking the willow wand upright in the ground, he that hits that rod at 50 yards, I call him an archer, fit to bear both bow and quiver before a king, and it were the stout King Richard himself. My grandsire, said Hubert, drew a good bow at the Battle of Hastings, and never shot at such a mark in his life, neither will I. If this yeoman can cleave that rod, I give him the bucklers, or rather, I yield to the devil that is in his jerkin, and not to any human skill. A man can but do his best, and I will not shoot where I am sure to miss. I might as well shoot at the edge of our parson's whittle, or at a wheat straw, or at a sunbeam, as at a twinkling white streak which I can hardly see. Cowardly dog, said Prince John. Sirrah Locksley, do you shoot, but if you hit such a mark, I will say that you are the first man ever did so. However it be, you shall not crow over us with a mere show of superior skill. I will do my best, as Hubert says, answered Locksley. No man can do more. So saying, he again bent his bow, but at the present occasion looked with attention to his weapon, and changed the string, which he thought was no longer truly round, having been a little frayed by the two former shots. He then took his aim with some deliberation, and the multitude awaited the event in breathless silence. The archer vindicated their opinion of his skill. His arrow split the willow rod against which it was aimed. A jubilee of acclamations followed, and even Prince John, in admiration of Locksley's skill, lost for an instant his dislike of this person. "These 20 nobles," he said, "which with the bugle you have fairly won, are my own. We will make them 50. If you will take livery and service with us as a yeoman of our bodyguard, and be near to our person, for never did so strong a hand bend a bow, or so true an eye direct a shaft." "Pardon me, noble prince," said Locksley, "but I have vowed that if I ever take service, it should be with your royal brother, King Richard. These 20 nobles I leave to Hubert, who has this day drawn as brave a bow as his grandsire did at Hastings. Had his modesty not refused the trial, he would have hit the wand as well as I." Hubert shook his head as he received with reluctance the bounty of the stranger, and Locksley, anxious to escape further observation, mixed with the crowd and was seen no more. The victorious archer would not perhaps have escaped John's attention so easily had not that prince had other subjects of anxious and more important meditation pressing upon his mind at that instant. He called upon his chamberlain as he gave the signal for retiring from the lists, and commanded him instantly to gallop to Ashby and seek out Isaac the Jew. "Tell the dog," he said, "to send me before sundown 2,000 crowns. He knows the security, but you may show him this ring for a token. The rest of the money must be paid at York within 6 days. If he neglects, I will have the unbelieving villain's head. Look that you pass him not on the way, for the circumcised slave was displaying his stolen finery amongst us." So saying, the prince resumed his horse and returned to Ashby. The whole crowd broke up and dispersed upon his retreat. Chapter 14. Prince John held his high festival in the castle of Ashby. This was not the same building of which the stately ruins still interest the traveller, and which was erected at a later period by the Lord Hastings, High Chamberlain of England, one of the first victims of the tyranny of Richard III, and yet better known as one of Shakespeare's characters than by his historical fame. The castle and town of Ashby, at this time, belonged to Roger de Quincey, Earl of Winchester, who during the period of our history was absent in the Holy Land. Prince John, in the meanwhile, occupied his castle and disposed of his domains without scruple, and seeking at present to dazzle men's eyes by the hospitality and magnificence, had given orders for great preparations in order to render the banquet as splendid as possible. The purveyors of the prince, who exercised on this and other occasions the full authority of royalty, had swept the country of all that could be collected, which was esteemed fit for their master's table. Guests were also invited in great numbers, and the necessity in which he then found himself of courting popularity, Prince John had extended his invitation to a few distinguished Saxon and Danish families, as well as to the Norman nobility and gentry of the neighbourhood. However despised and degraded on ordinary occasions, the great numbers of the Anglo-Saxons must necessarily render them formidable in the civil commotions which seemed approaching, and it was an obvious point of policy to secure some popularity with their leaders. It was accordingly the prince's intention, which he for some time maintained, to treat these unwanted guests with a courtesy to which they had been little accustomed. But although no man with less scruple made his ordinary habits and feelings bend to his interest, it was the misfortune of this prince and his levity that and petulance were perpetually breaking out and undoing all that had been gained by his previous dissimulation. Of this fickle temper he gave a memorable example in Ireland when, sent there by his father, Henry II, with the purpose of buying golden opinions of the inhabitants of that new and important acquisition to the English crown. Upon this occasion, the Irish chieftains contended which should first offer to the young prince their loyal homage and the kiss of peace. But instead of receiving their salutations with courtesy, John and his petulant attendants could not resist the temptation of pulling the long beards of the Irish chieftains, a conduct which, as might be expected, was highly resented by these insulted dignitaries and produced fatal consequences to the English domination in Ireland. It is necessary to keep these inconsistencies of John's character in view that the reader may understand his conduct during the present evening. In execution of the resolution which he had formed during his cooler moments, Prince John received Cedric and Athelstane with distinguished courtesy, and expressed his disappointment without resentment when the indisposition of Rowena was alleged by the former as a reason for her not attending upon his gracious summons. Cedric and Athelstane were both dressed in the ancient Saxon garb, which, although not unhandsome in itself, and in the present instance composed of costly materials, was so remote in the shape and appearance from that of the other guests that Prince John took great credit to himself with Waldemere Fitzurse for refraining from laughter at a sight which the fashion of the day rendered ridiculous. Yet in the eye of sober judgment, the short close tunic and the long mantle of the Saxons was a more graceful as well as more convenient dress than the garb of the Normans, whose undergarment was a long doublet so loose as to resemble a shirt or a wagoner's frock, covered by a cloak of scanty dimensions, neither fit to defend the wearer from the cold or from rain, and the only purpose of which appeared to be to display as much fur, embroidery, and jewellery work as the ingenuity of the tailor could contrive to lay upon it. The Emperor Charlemagne, in whose reign they were first introduced, seems to have been very sensible of the inconveniences arising from the fashion of his garment. "In heaven's name," said he, "to what purpose serve these abridged cloaks? If we are in bed, they are no cover. On horseback, they are no protection from the wind and the rain. And when seated, they do not guard our legs from damp or the frost." Nevertheless, spite of this imperial objurgation, the short cloaks continued in fashion down to the time of which we treat, and particularly amongst the princes of the House of Anjou. They were therefore in universal use amongst Prince John's courtiers, and the long mantle which formed the upper garment of the Saxons was held in proportional derision. The guests were seated at a table which groaned under the quantity of good cheer. The numerous cooks who attended on the prince's progress, having exerted all their art in varying the forms in which the ordinary provisions were served up, and succeeded almost as well as the modern professors of the culinary art in rendering them perfectly unlike their natural appearance. Besides these dishes of domestic origin, there were various delicacies brought from foreign parts, and a quantity of rich pastry as well as of the simnel bread and wastel cakes, which were only used at the tables of the highest nobility. The banquet was crowned with the richest wines, both foreign and domestic. But though luxurious, the Norman nobles were not, generally speaking, an intemperate race. While indulging themselves in the pleasures of the table, they aimed at delicacy, but avoided excess, and were apt to attribute gluttony and drunkenness to the vanquished Saxons as vices peculiar to their inferior station. Prince John, indeed, and those who courted his pleasure by imitating his foibles, were apt to indulge to excess in the pleasure of the trencher and the goblet, and indeed it is well known that his death was occasioned by a surfeit upon peaches and new ale. His conduct, however, was an exception to the general manners of his countrymen. With sly gravity, interrupted only by private signs to each other, the Norman knights and nobles beheld the ruder demeanour of Athelstane and Cedric at a banquet to the form and fashion of which they were unaccustomed. And while their manners were thus the subject of sarcastic observation, the untaught Saxons unwittingly transgressed several of the arbitrary rules established for the regulation of society. Now it is well known that a man may with more impunity be guilty of an actual breach either of real or good breeding or of good morals than appear ignorant of the most minute point of fashionable etiquette. Thus Cedric, who dried his hands with a towel instead of suffering the moisture to exhale by waving them gracefully in the air, incurred more ridicule than his companion Athelstane when he swallowed to his own single share the whole of a large pastry composed of the most exquisite foreign delicacies and termed at that time a currum pie. When, however, it was discovered by a serious cross-examination that the Thane of Königsberg, or Franklin as the Normans termed him, had no idea what he had been devouring, and that he had taken the contents of the carom pie for larks and pigeons, whereas, in fact, they were bacificos and nightingales, his ignorance brought him in for an ample share of the ridicule which would have been more justly bestowed on his gluttony. The long feast, at length, its end, and, while the goblets circulated freely, men talked of the feats of the preceding tournament, of the unknown victor in the archery games, of the Black Knight whose self-denial had induced him to withdraw from the honours he had won, and of the gallant Ivanhoe who had so dearly bought the honours of the day. The topics were treated with military frankness, and the jests and laughs went around the hall. The brow of Prince John alone was overclouded during these discussions. Some overpowering care seemed agitating his mind, and it was only when he received occasional hints from his attendants that he seemed to take interest in what was passing around him. On such occasions, he would start up, quaff a cup of wine, as if to raise his spirits, and then mingle in the conversation by some observation made abruptly or at random. "We drink this beaker," said he, "to the health of Wilfred of Ivanhoe, champion of this passage of arms, and grieved that his wound renders him absent from our board, let all fill to the pledge, and especially Cedric of Rotherwood, the worthy father of a son so promising." "No, my lord," replied Cedric, standing up and placing on the table his untasted cup. "I yield not the name of son to the disobedient youth who at once despises my commands and relinquishes the manners and customs of his fathers." "'Tis impossible," cried Prince John with well-feigned astonishment, "that so gallant a knight should be an unworthy or disobedient son." "Yet, my lord," answered Cedric, "so it is with this Wilfred. He left my homely dwelling to mingle with the gay nobility of your brother's court, where he learned to do those tricks of horsemanship which you prize so highly. He left it contrary to my wish and command. In the days of Alfred, that would have been termed disobedience, aye, and a crime severely punishable." "Alas," replied Prince John with a deep sigh of affected sympathy, "since your own son was a follower of my unhappy brother, it need not be inquired where or from whom he learned the lesson of filial disobedience. Thus spake Prince John, wilfully forgetting that of all the sons of Henry II, though no one was free from the charge, he himself had been most distinguished for rebellion and ingratitude to his father. "I think," said he after a moment's pause, "that my brother proposed to confer upon his favourite the rich manor of Ivanhoe."
"He did endow him with it," answered Cedric. "Nor is it my least quarrel with my son that he stooped to hold as a feudal vassal the very domains which his fathers possessed in free and independent right."
"Oh, we shall have your willing sanction, good Cedric," said Prince John, "to confer this fief upon a person whose dignity will not be diminished by holding land of the British crown. Sir Reginald Front de Bœuf," he said, turning towards that baron, "I trust you will keep the goodly barony of Ivanhoe, that Sir Wilfred shall not incur his father's displeasure by again entering upon that fief."
"By St. Anthony," answered the black-browed giant, "I will consent that your highness shall hold me a Saxon, if either Cedric or Wilfred, or the best that ever bore English blood, shall wrench from me the gift which your highness has granted me."
"Whoever shall call thee Saxon, Sir Baron," replied Cedric, offended at a mode of expression by which the Normans frequently expressed their habitual contempt of the English, "will do thee an honour as great as it is undeserved." Front de Bœuf would have replied, but Prince John's petulance and levity got the start.
"Assuredly," said he, "my lords, the noble Cedric speaks truth, and his race may claim precedence over us as much in the length of their pedigrees as in the longitude of their cloaks.
They go before us indeed in the field, as deer before dogs," said Malvoisin.
"And with good right, they go before us, forget not," said Prior Aymer, "the superior decency and decorum of their manners."
"Their singular abstemiousness and temperance," said De Bracy, forgetting the plan which promised him a Saxon bride.
"Together with the courage and conduct," said Brian de Bois Guilbert, "by which they distinguish themselves at Hastings and elsewhere."
While with smooth and smiling cheek, the courtiers each in turn followed their prince's example and aimed a shaft of ridicule at Cedric, the face of the Saxon became inflamed with passion, and he glanced his eyes fiercely from one to another, as if the quick succession of so many injuries had prevented his replying to them in turn, or like a baited bull who, surrounded by his tormentors, is at a loss to choose from among them the immediate object of his revenge. At length he spoke in a voice half choked with passion, and addressing himself to Prince John as the head and font of the offence that he had received,
"Whatever," he said, "have been the follies and vices of our race, a Saxon would have been held niddering," the most emphatic term for abject worthlessness, "who should in his own hall, and while his own wine cup passed, have treated or suffered to be treated an unoffending guest as your highness has this day beheld me used. And whatever was the misfortune of our fathers on the field of Hastings, those may at least be silent." Here he looked at Front de Bœuf and the Templar, "who have within these few hours once and again lost saddle and stirrup before the lance of a Saxon."
"Oh, by my faith, a biting jest," said Prince John. "How like you it, sirs? Our Saxon subjects rise in spirit and courage, become shrewd in wit, and bold in bearing in these unsettled times. What say ye, my lords? By this good light, I hold it best we must take to our galleys and return to Normandy in time."
"Oh, for fear of the Saxons," said De Bracy, laughing, We should need no weapons but our hunting spears to bring these boars to bay.
A truce with your millery and raillery, Sir Knights," said Fitz.
"And it were well," he added, addressing the prince, "that your highness should assure the worthy Cedric there is no insult intended him by jests which must sound but harshly in the ear of a stranger."
"Insult?" answered Prince John, resuming his courtesy of demeanour. "I trust it will not be thought that I could mean or permit any to be offered in my presence. Here, I fill my cup to Cedric himself, since he refuses to pledge his son's health." That's our book reading for today. Well, Cedric's going to reply to that little insult, you can bet. And who is the Black Knight? Who can he be? Obviously capable, but Sir Sluggett, who then rose to the occasion and downed two Norman knights in quick succession to protect Wilfred of Ivanhoe? And what of Locksley? How does he fit into all of this? We'll find out more next Monday. Until then, Braidwood, I hope that you keep well and you keep safe.